wolfman's knocking at your door.
Hello, this is Elaine Bally on this evening's edition of Our City, Our Lives. And the piece that you just heard is called Matriarch Blues. It was written and sung by Bernice Reagan. And she says those are tidbits and pieces of things that she heard that express for her those periods of depression, which on occasion have come to me. Our guest this evening is Hattie Gossett. And Hattie is a writer, lecturer, educator, many, many other things besides. Hattie, I'm glad you were able to join us tonight.
Yes, nice to be here.
Hattie, we've been talking about the topic before we went on the air of black women, women's liberation, different myths that exist about women. And what would you say was be the largest myth that has caused the most damage in terms of black women today?
I think that I would say the thing that I call the BM theory, which the sociologists call the black matriarchy theory, that usually boils down to mean that black women are the root of most of the trouble that black people experience, because we're too aggressive and we're not feminine enough and we make too much money and, you know, that whole number, which leads many people to say that if black women would just be quiet and sit down and stand back a little bit, that everything would be okay. So, but in fact, when you are in the position that Bernice Reagan just said, it's so difficult, you can't even stumble because you can't fall, you know? It becomes very obvious that the thing for you to do is not sit back and be quiet, you know? So, you know, that I would say that that's the most damaging, you know, dangerous.
Well, a couple of things come to me when you say that. One is the proliferation of the women's movement has educated a lot of women as to their what they can expect, what they should expect in the world today in terms of themselves, their personal lives, their careers. And you talk about the matriarch theory and about black women being accused of being out of their place. It would seem that with all of the talk and with the ERA ratification from many states, it's only three more left, that black women would be aware that they can take another role in society.
Well, first of all, I want to make it clear that I'm not selling us short in what I'm about to say. In other words, I'm not unaware that black women are aware of women's issues. But the problem that comes in is because the leadership that not only black women, but black people look to national and local political leadership and social leadership, black, for the most part, doesn't deal with women's issues. It doesn't deal with sexism. It tries to deny, in fact, that sexism is a problem for black people. So that for black women, I mean, if you read, you know, magazines and newspapers and you pay attention to what's happening for women, of course, you know, it's you're going to become aware of the fact that a lot of what they're talking about concerns you. But then when you look to our leadership or our so-called leadership, and you don't hear that leadership reinforcing those ideas and encouraging you to be concerned about those issues, then it becomes very confusing and schizophrenic. And a lot of women black women begin to feel that if we support women's issues, or if we show concern about women's issues, that we are somehow betraying the struggle, quote unquote. So, you know, I mean, there's a whole, you know, number happening with that that I think is confusing, you know. And it goes back to I'm sure he has regretted making this remark many times, but It goes back to, in the 60s, the remark that Stokely Carmichael made, that the position of the woman in the struggle is prone, you know. I don't know what his position about things is now. I hope that he has changed that. But that remark came at a very crucial time. It came at the time when, you know, the whole women's movement, the issue of women was in the process of being revitalized. And everybody was looking around to see what black women were going to do. And we were sold a bill of goods to make us think that it was not in our interest to be concerned with women's issues. Nobody tried to help us to see that oppression is oppression, whether it's on a racial level or on a sexual level, and that if you say you're going to fight oppression, that you can't really get all that choosy about, well, which one you're going to fight and which one you're not, especially if you're a woman. That kind of stuff wasn't pointed out to us, and we weren't encouraged.
Well, one of the things that I've heard said, just in terms of women, not just black women, but women in general, is that women are taking jobs away from men.
That is, you know, highly ludicrous. I mean, whenever somebody says that, the first thing that you're supposed to do I mean, it's funny. It's so funny. It's hard to answer it in a serious way, you know, because when you look at the types of jobs that men do in this society, and you look at the types of jobs that women do in this society, I mean, you know right away that that's crazy, you know. Most black people do what the census report calls operative work, which means, you know, working in factories for the most part. So now, in the census statistics, there are 41 jobs listed for male operatives, and there are only about 20-some jobs listed for female operatives. So that immediately lets you know that men and women do different types of work in this society, and that there are jobs, most of the jobs that men do, women don't get hired to do those jobs. So I would like to know what jobs they are talking about. Women are still not driving trucks, tractors, you know, stringing telephone lines, you know.
Not in large scale at any rate.
No, no. You know, the traditional male jobs in this society, I don't see women taking those jobs away from anybody. And I certainly don't see black women taking them away. I think that when people say that, that they're looking at the tokens, you know, that exist on a corporate level and on a government level and in other fields. And, you know, I mean, the tokens get a lot of play, so that it's made to appear that all women are getting over. But a token is a token, whether it's a woman token or a black token, it's still a token. So if Ms. Magazine has an ad that shows one woman working on a stringing telephone wires up on the pole, not to take away from that, but that doesn't mean that women wholesale are able now to do those kind of jobs. So, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I just want to pause for a minute, because Jerry Hatch asked me to make an announcement, and before I forget, I would like, if the physician who called last Monday night on Our City, Our Lives, excuse me, he was the DES father, and Jerry Hatch would like you to please call after the show and leave your name and number for her, because she wasn't able to get it from you before. So if you're listening, and if you were the one who called last Monday night, the DES father, if you would please do that, we'd appreciate it. Now, another thing in terms of, you're talking about token jobs and women taking away men's work. There's another thing that's going on now, saying that there are more opportunities for black women than there are for black men. And one of the reasons for that being that if you hire a black woman, you're filling two quotas at the same time.
Yeah, that's another, you know, craziness that is flying around in the air, you know. You know, it's another one of those kinds of myths. With the advent of equal employment opportunity and that kind of social reform program, and again, the token, it's being made to appear that in fact is what is happening. But when you stop and examine and notice that the society is still male-dominated and is still white-dominated, then it sort of becomes obvious that that's not true, you know. When you look at any board of directors of any major corporation, there's no danger yet that women are getting ready to take over. You know, most boards of directors are still male and they're still white. For instance, you know, and I mean that kind of thing goes all the way down the line. So again, you have to ask, what is the reality to support that myth? You know, the people who are perpetrating these ideas, what are they basing these ideas on? What is the reality that they can give as an example, you know? And usually when you hear people say that, they'll say, well, they can point out a token to you. And then they use that token as proof for making this big generalization. But usually, once you get past looking at the token, you find that it's just not true that a woman can be hired more quickly than a man, because white people are still operating under sexist kinds of ideas. And so, I mean, they're still running things too. So, I mean, they are more interested in promoting men than they are in promoting women. So, again, when you look at reality, you see that there's really not very much basis for these myths that are being perpetrated.
Okay, let me ask you another question, because this is another thing that comes up very often, and that is that there's a possible difference of attitudes between black women and white women toward work. Do you think that's a valid statement?
I don't know. That's something that's interesting to explore.
Yeah, I'm asking from the term of very often the women's liberation movement has been accused of being a very middle-class, white-oriented movement, and that women who are going out to work now, who come from that particular segment of society, are doing it more or less to get out of the house as opposed to for a real need.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing, to be fair to be fair, I think there's a difference between the white woman who is often active in women's liberation and who is, you know, vocal or visible, and the average white woman. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So most of the women that you see that are vocal, white women that you see that are vocal in women's liberation, they seem to be the type of women who could work or not work.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to, I mean, you know, there's not that pressure on them. But then I don't think that all white women fall into that category. I mean, I think that there are probably a lot of white women who work because they have to work, just like we do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one difference. I mean, you know, I mean, that's one point
mm-hmm.
that I could make with that. Now, If we look at the white woman who is working because she has to work, then I don't know how much difference there is between her
mm-hmm.
and the black woman who's working because she has to work. But now, I would say that there is probably a difference in, as you said, the type of white woman who is usually associated with women's liberation and her motives for working.
The reason I ask that question is because, again, this is another reason very often given by black women or black men as to why black women should not be involved in liberation, women's liberation movement. I hate to say women's liberation because it's really people liberation to me,
yeah.
as far as I see it.
Yeah, it ties in with other struggles against oppression,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Then the other problem that we have is the accusation, and I guess this is not really a problem that's limited to black women, but it's a problem that women in general have. It's the accusation of being, of emasculating the husband or the male in the family by going out and working, also not embarrassing him, but letting the public know that he is not making enough money to support you in the way that he feels that you should be accustomed to. I mean, there are very myriad of different excuses that are given to women as to why they should not go out to work, whether they are going to supplement the income or whether they are going to develop themselves.
Mm, so we should all starve so that the male ego can be preserved, right? I mean, again, we have a myth. The myth is that a family unit is supposed to be able to be sustained on the income of the male, right? when in actuality, the economic system that we live under is such that the average person, the average family, cannot survive off of the income of the male, which is, you know, anywhere from, say, $8,000, with black people lower than that, $5,000, $6,000, to maybe $20,000. And you can't raise a family and provide medical care and education and all the stuff that you need, to say nothing of the stuff that you want, you know, with one income. So on the one hand, you have that reality. On the other hand, you have the myth that says that for a man to really be a man, arum, arum, then he must be able to be John Wayne and, you know, rough it off, you know, and allow us to be Miss Chiffon and just sit at home. So now the woman is in the middle, you know. She sees what the needs of the family are. And so, I mean, what is she going to do? Is she going to lay back and help preserve this myth? Or is she going to try to be a force for bringing some reality into the situation? Reality not only in terms of how are we going to meet our needs, but reality in terms of what are these roles that we are playing here? And how realistic are these roles? How realistic is it for us to be playing these roles? And where did these roles come from anyway? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that, you know, black women, when we go along with that and we think, you know, that what we're supposed to do is support, you know, those myths, we are hurting ourselves, you know, and our families and our husbands, you know, but especially ourselves, because again, it's like, you know, you can't stumble and you don't have any place to fall. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's like group pressure or peer pressure that keeps black women from actively participating in a wholehearted level in, say, women's causes? For example, when women march for jobs, women march for daycare centers, well, not so much daycare centers, but when they march for, say, ratification of ERA, when you look at the group of women that you see a black woman from time to time, but it seems that these same issues do affect us.
Mm. Well, I would say it's two or three things that you have to look at with that. As you pointed out earlier, unfortunately, for better or for worse, but unfortunately, the women's movement, quote unquote, is still rather middle class and white. And I don't say that in an accusing manner, but just as a fact, right? So how do you get grassroots participation in that kind of situation? That's, you know, one mm-hmm. thing. And that's, you know, real important. Then, as I was pointing out before, black leadership is still, for the most part, male, and is still, for the most part, not dealing with or encouraging black people to relate to sexism and women's issues. So, so when you have, you look at those two factors, and then you look at, especially in this period that we're living through now, just the difficulty of survival on a day-to-day basis, you can begin to understand some of the reasons why more black women don't participate. And then also, we are always being beat over the head and slurred for being vocal and being pushy, as they say. So, I mean, when you add all of those things up together, you know, it's like the black woman who chooses to step out and speak, she really has a hard way to go, you know, because mm-hmm. she's not getting a lot of support from hardly anybody, mm-hmm. you know. Generally, I mean, to just cap up the question, I would say that the mores in our community are not are such that it makes it difficult for us as women to be vocal. You know, I mean, like the kind of pressure that is put on us when we are vocal is so heavy, you know. And we receive little encouragement from within the community and little encouragement from without the community, from outside of the community, so that, you know what I'm saying? It's just, it's very difficult.
When you talk about black women being vocal, it brings to mind people like Shirley Chisholm, who ran against tremendous odds and became congresswoman from Brooklyn. Barbara Jackson, who gave a really rousing address at the last Democratic National Convention. But we haven't heard anything from her since. Do you think that that also has something to do with the fact that women are not expected to speak out?
Yeah, I mean, Shirley Chisholm is an example. Fannie Lou Hamer is another kind of example. When people talk about what went on in the South during the 60s, you know, with the voter registration movement and that kind of thing, she is not a person that comes readily to mind, you know. And they have a very little patronizing way of dealing with her. You know, it's almost like
Rosa Parks.
Yeah.
Who started it all, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Rosa Parks started it all. Right?
She's the one, you know. So, and I mean, most people don't even know that name. But to get back to Shirley Chisholm, which is a more immediate example, she was criticized not because her platform, there was something wrong with her platform, although she may have been due for criticism on her platform, but that's not the kind of criticism that she received. She was criticized because it was thought that she was taking something away from black dudes by running for office. And when she decided to run for the presidency, I mean, that was, oh, wow. She was the last dirty so-and-so, you know? And again, it wasn't because of her platform, you know? It was because she was a woman. And it was, I mean, people were saying this on in print and on the radio and stuff that, you know, she is really damaging the moral fiber and so on, so on, so of the black community because she is not allowing black men, so on, so on, so on, so on, so.
But there's a schizophrenic thing that I see there in terms of black women not speaking out as, say, representatives of our communities. But yet, what I find is that in terms of organizing, women will turn out to demonstrate for more school buses, for a stoplight, for a daycare center, or whatever.
We don't recognize the power that we really have, you know, I would say. And to silence whatever critics might be listening that might try to say that we're having an anti-male conversation. It's true. You know, sexism has a really ugly effect on women because it really does make us think that we can't do anything. And it really does make us think that if we go to the local Board of Education meetings and sit through these meetings and you know, we, you know, wade through all this bureaucratic, you know, nonsense that they run down on you when you ask them why there aren't any black teachers in the school. I mean, we go through women, black community, everyday women at work, we do all of that. But then something happens that when the movement gets started, it's always led by a man. And, I mean, Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, right? So that, there is a mechanism in us as women that makes us think that we really are supposed to lay back and be cool and let the dude take the lead, you know? So, I mean, I would say that that mechanism is a direct result of sexism, you know, that, and the particular way that sexism comes down on black women. that that's at least part, a good part of what happens there.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, that indicates a need for grassroots participation from women in general. And how does one go about affecting that? How do you do that? I mean, how do you educate just the working woman, the woman who's trying to supplement her husband's income, the woman who is not one to go out for causes, who is not one that's going to march for equal rights amendment. But how do you reach those women?
Well, when you're talking about black women, when you look at the organs of communication that are open to us, you know, we have Ebony and we have Essence, you know, and we have the various black TV shows and radio shows that exist.